across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Bigger rate bills for the big houses under new proposals being put forward by Stormont's Finance Minister Sinn Féin's Caoimhe Archibald says it's a part of a package of measures to make the system fairer, and she wants the executive to move quickly so the plan can be put in place next year. We'll find out what you think.
For me, it's about ensuring that our rating system is fair, is progressive, is equitable, and that any reliefs that are in place are achieving the policy objectives that they were put in place to do.
We'll settle out for you in the next few minutes. Sir Keir Starmer has warned Labour's first budget in more than a decade will raise taxes. He says it's necessary to create opportunities and rebuild public services. What's going to be in this budget tomorrow? We'll try to find out. Also today, the former Alliance leader, Lord Alderdice, has said it is not politically realistic for the Alliance Party to refuse to declare where it stands ahead of any forthcoming border poll. There's a lot around today. The Irish government is being urged to consider setting up a scheme to regulate the use of cannabis and some other drugs which are currently illegal. Should we do the same thing here? And the son of one of the most famous and respected television presenters and chat show hosts, no, it's not me, the legendary Sir Michael Parkinson, is using artificial intelligence, or AI, to recreate his dad's voice to interview current celebrities.
This is Michael Parkinson, or at least a version of me in this rather curious AI form. Now, I'll be honest with you, I haven't the foggiest idea how any of this technology actually works, but I must say I'm excited by it all.
Wow, that's scary, isn't it? That's him recreated. Tuesday, October the 29th, the biggest show in the country, coming at you right now.
Call 03030 80 55 55. Standard rates apply. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Get the news. Make the news. Be the news. The biggest show in the country starts now.
The Stephen Nolan Show.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on the Nolan Show. It's a week when we'll be talking an awful lot about money, because the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will be standing up tomorrow to deliver the autumn budget. Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, has already flagged that his colleague will be giving out some very bad news to some taxpayers throughout the UK. So that's tomorrow. Today, our Finance Minister here in Northern Ireland, Caoimhe Archibald, we learn that some of our rates will be going up. Our business and economics editor, John Campbell, has been talking to the finance minister. Let's have a listen.
As you will know, the Secretary of State last year commissioned a consultation on revenue raising in relation to rates. He had a number of proposals in that which were very binary, keep them or remove them. But 1,400 people took the time to respond to that. And so I have also taken the time to consider those responses, and I have now brought proposals to the executive, short, medium and longer term proposals. For me, it's about ensuring that our rating system is fair, is progressive, is equitable, and that any reliefs that are in place are achieving the policy objectives that they were put in place to do.
Talking about progressive and equitable, that sounds a bit like the language the Prime Minister and the Chancellor have been using lately, talking about people with the broader shoulders bearing more of the burden. Are you suggesting there in broad terms that perhaps people who are wealthier, who have bigger houses, can expect to be paying a bit more in future?
Well, if you look at, for example, our domestic max cap, that has been set at the level that it currently is since 2007. So I think it's timely to take a look at that. What the British Secretary of State had proposed in his consultation was the removal of the cap. That would have resulted in some people having rates bills up to £25,000. And while it's not a direct comparison, the highest council taxes in England are in the region of around £5,000, so five times as much. I don't think that's I think that would be excessive. So what I am proposing is a more proportionate response and a proportionate elevation of the max cap. And I'll not get into the numbers of it, but because it is for the executive to take a position on it, but that is the proposal that I have put forward to them.
And just to remind people that the max cap is basically setting a certain ceiling, and that no house will pay, it's valued basically higher than that ceiling. So we could be in a position where the ceiling rises, and therefore some of those more valuable houses, they can expect to attract a bigger rates bill going forward.
That's one of the proposals that I have put forward. Likewise, I have, similar to the business rates approach, I have put forward short, medium and long-term proposals. Our domestic valuation list has similarly been in place since 2006, 2007, and it hasn't been refreshed. I think that we need to look again at that. And just to outline, a revaluation isn't about raising more money. It's about ensuring there's a fair distribution of rates across the system. That's something that will take some planning to put in place. It will be beyond this mandate, but it's one of the longer term proposals that I have made to the executive, is that we would look at a domestic revaluation as well.
Well, John Campbell is with us now this morning. Good morning to you, John.
Morning.
So if we walk through this, those people whose properties are worth more than 400 grand, they're going to get a dunt, are they, if this goes through?
No. We just need to be careful about what we're talking about here. So the 400 grand refers to valuations made back in 2005. So it's not the current market valuation of the houses. So if you're sitting there in a house which is worth about £400,000, you think my rates are going up because of this, that's not the case. You have to refer to the valuation list. So the rateable value will be printed on your rates bill. It's also available online. You can see the real value of anybody's house that you like. So what we're talking about here are the 8,000 most valuable houses in Northern Ireland, effectively, because the system we have at the moment assumes that no house is worth more than £400,000 at 2005 prices for the purpose of rates. And the way the rate system works is the more valuable your house, the more rates you pay. But we have this cap in that assumes that no house is worth more than £400,000 at that rateable valuation. So that means that those 8,000 most valuable houses, therefore, you know, they pay less than they otherwise would. The proposal is that the level of that cap will be raised. I understand it might be quite a modest increase, maybe, you know, raising it to less than £500,000. But the upshot of that will be, therefore, that those most valuable houses will attract a rates bill which is a bit higher. And so it's just to illustrate sort of the way the cap works at the moment. I was just looking on one of the property websites, and I can see that there's quite a nice extended house for sale in East Belfast for about £600,000. And its rates are about £3,600 a year. And then I look, there's an 11-bed mansion in Kiltraw on sale for £3.5 million, but the rates on the mansion are only £15 more than that kind of much more modest house in East Belfast. So the idea is that the people in the most valuable houses would pay a bit more, but not a huge amount more. We should remember that there was originally a proposal from the Secretary of State that he would just abolish the rates cap altogether. So there'd be no relief. So that would mean that, you know, in some cases, the most valuable houses would be looking at rates bills of £25,000 a year. So it's not going to be anything like that. It's just going to be a fairly modest uplift in the cap. And I understand that the amount of additional revenue it will actually bring in per year is likely to be in the low single-digit millions. So it's not going to raise a transformational amount of money for public services or anything like that. It's not going to, I think, greatly financially inconvenience those with the most valuable houses. And in some ways, it is part of a package which the Minister says she's intending to try and make the rate system overall sort of more fair and equitable.
But John, presumably one of the questions here then, that if this is not going to raise an awful lot of money, in an environment where Stormont needs an awful lot of money, why hasn't she gone for using the rate system to bring in vital revenue to the coffers of Northern Ireland and take it off the rich? Why hasn't she done that?
There's perhaps a calculation that would be politically a bit more difficult to do that, that you wouldn't want to have a system where the property taxes in Northern Ireland were getting wildly out of whack with the rest of the UK. But that's not to say that further down the line that there will be more rates increases, because fundamentally the way it works in Northern Ireland is we don't have that many rich people. So if you're trying to base it, you know, raising lots of money on taxing rich people, you're never going to bring in that much. You kind of need to cast your net much more widely. So the easiest thing which Stormont could do to bring in substantially more money is to increase the regional rate by more than the rate of inflation. And we know that, you know, there's been for a long time Stormont have tried to keep rates increases sort of at or below inflation. But if they want to increase the amount of money that they're bringing in a substantial way, they would need to kind of do some measure like that across the board. Now, that's not something which is, as I understand it, is on the agenda at this time, but that is something which is open to the executive to do really at any time of their choosing. They could say, right, we will make the case, as Keir Starmer was sort of making the case yesterday, for higher taxes, for improved public services. The door is always open for Stormont to do that. That wouldn't involve any kind of reform. And so there's just one other thing I should mention, which the minister was talking about, which is kind of a longer term project, which is a revaluation of domestic properties for the purposes of rates. Because as I was saying, the last time a valuation took place was in 2005, whereas commercial properties like shops and offices, that they get revalued every 3 years. And what happens in those revaluation exercises is not about trying to raise more money in total, but it can lead to kind of a redistribution of who pays what. So, you know, for example, you could be in an area where house prices have increased a lot, say by more than the Northern Ireland average, and if there was a revaluation, that could bring you in a position where your rates would go up. Maybe you're in an area where house prices have not risen very much or have fallen, and in a revaluation exercise, that would mean your rates could come down. But the minister was saying that is not going to happen in the lifetime of this assembly. That's a much longer term piece of work.
Is that not yet another opportunity, or does it just take too long? That she had, if that could have been put on a fast track scheme, reevaluate everyone's houses, is that not another opportunity to at least? There'd be very few houses in Northern Ireland, John, would have gone down since 2005.
Yeah, it's really what you're talking about is the difference of in the changes. So you'll have some areas which will have, say, gone up by more than the average, and other areas where they might have gone up but by only a little bit. And then, so you would have basically be shuffling around who's kind of shoulders the burden by the area that might have improved more. But that is a kind of like a, it's quite a big piece of work, because effectively you need to revalue the entire housing stock in Northern Ireland. So you need to work out how you're going to do that. Is that all just a desktop exercise? You know, do you need to basically be paying outside agents to help with that? So, but the minister was clear that's a bigger piece of work.
I don't understand some of this. I'm going to frustrate you because you understand it all. I don't. But, like, for example, where in Northern Ireland have house prices gone down since 2005?
No. I'm not saying that they've gone down. I'm saying it's basically the relative movements. So you will say house prices in Northern Ireland, this is just an example, say house prices overall have increased by 10%. In one area, they've gone up by 15%. But in another area, they've only gone up by 5%. When you're undertaking the revaluation exercise, that would mean that people who have houses in the area where they've gone up by 15%, they would be paying a bit more.
I understand.
The people in the 5% area would be paying a bit less. So it's about relative movements, not the absolute.
I understand. But it's agreed that those 2005, by the very nature of what we're saying, it's 2005 valuations, they are out of date. So what?
Yes.
So what Stormont, and these are all proposals, what Stormont could propose to do, could decide to do, is take, for example, a low average of increases of property and bring them up to date. And that would bring, it would bring pain to people because they'd be paying more in their rates, but it would bring extra revenue into the executive, wouldn't it?
No. That's not the way the revaluation works. The revaluation isn't about increasing the total of amount that you bring in. It's supposed to be revenue neutral. It's about basically moving around who pays more, who pays less.
But why is it supposed to be revenue neutral? Why could it not be revenue?
Well, that's just generally the basis on which revaluations work. So the 3-year revaluation which takes place in commercial property, that is always aimed through revenue unit rule. But to be honest, I think we're going down a bit of a rabbit hole on this one because it's not really the important one because it's not happening anytime soon, and the Minister's been clear about that in terms of her proposals.
So in terms then of what we did talk about, people in the more expensive houses, that rate cap going up, it's not going to bring in more money either. So are we in a situation here?
It'll bring in a little bit more. Yeah. So I it would be substantially less than 10 million. I think we're talking like single digit millions of additional revenue is probably what it would bring in.
So I've taken a long-winded way of getting around to the most important question. Has the finance minister delivered any mechanism with which to bring in significant amounts of money into Northern Ireland?
Well, they don't need a new mechanism. All they need to do is put up the regional rate. So there's and the finance minister can do that every year with the agreement of Stormont. So that there's not a really requirement to involve anything new. So this is about sort of around a sort of broader package, which is looking at other kind of rates reliefs which exist for commercial and non-commercial properties. So I haven't seen the full package. I don't know the full extent of it, but what she's talking about is measures which would apply in the short, medium and long-term basis. So, for example, the short term, you could raise the revenue cap or raise the valuation cap for the next financial year, if there was agreement of the executive to do that, the revaluation exercise, which we talked about, that would be a longer term one. So it's not all about revenue raising. She would say some of it's about kind of fairness and equity. The rates cap would raise a little bit more, but fundamentally the way in which Stormont can raise more money, that already exists. It's the annual settling of the rates, and that is fundamentally, I think, a political and economic decision which the executive has to make every year.
And John, do we have a sense yet as to how the other political parties will react to this?
Well, the minister has brought this paper to the executive, so the fact that it hasn't all been signed off yet would maybe suggest that there is still a bit of work to be done to get everybody to reach a consensus on this. So obviously the other executive parties are the DUP and Alliance and the Ulster Unionists. So I don't know exactly what their attitudes are on this, but the minister, I think she's saying there's due to be, I think, another two executive meetings before the end of November, and she would be hoping to reach consensus on these issues by then. But the fact that it's not all the paper is there, but you know the policy hasn't come out the other side yet, suggests there is still a bit of work to be done.
We did bid them all the political parties today. I don't know if they're on recess. I don't know if they're sleeping or what they're doing. Maybe late night parties last night, but they're not around this morning. Finally, the budget tomorrow, John, where Rachel Rees, the Chancellor, will stand up. Are people likely to? What's the speculation around cigarettes and alcohol and fuel?
Cigarettes and alcohol generally they go up every year. In one way or another, fuel, there's a kind of a bit of ambiguity about this. There is this thing called the fuel duty escalator, which means fuel duty is supposed to go up every year. It's never been applied. And some of the briefing today has been that it won't apply this time either. There was also a temporary cut in fuel duty, which was announced under the last government. So it would be open to this government to say, well, that temporary cut was always due to expire. Again, it looks like they'll probably keep that in place for now. And then in terms of tax measures, the big one we've heard about is a tax paid by businesses called Employers National Insurance. And then there's other kind of things which could happen around what you might think of as sort of generally rich people taxes, things like capital gains and inheritance tax. That, you know, for example, the inheritance tax barely features in Northern Ireland. You know, I think the last year we have figures for, there was about 300 estates actually had to pay an inheritance tax. So that is a kind of very much a minority interest on this side of the water.
Okay. John, thanks very much indeed. Thank you. That's our business economics editor, John Campbell. Paul, first call of the day. Morning, Paul.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, look, I'd like to say this. People in the UK, the Western world, basically, they need to just accept that taxes are never going to go down. you're gonna keep paying more and more tax every generation, because there's no population coming behind to replace the baby boomers. Unless you bring immigration here to replace them, you need the load has to be shared amongst every individual person who's working.
Well, it depends what tax you're talking about, doesn't it?
Well, what I was looking at is, right, how many cars is there on the road in Northern Ireland? Would there be a million?
I have no idea.
Half a million?
Just here's what's the point?
Cars. But the point is this, if the devolved government here in Northern Ireland was give some type of tax part to raise taxes on car tax, see if there's like a half a million cars on the road privately, and the charge of an extra £20 a year, what's with that raise? 10 million alone every year. You know, there isn't enough tax powers gave the Northern Ireland individually. If you look at the councils...
Would you trust the political parties with more tax-raising powers here?
Yes.
You think they've got what it takes, do you?
Separate tax-raising powers from the Treasury. They would be able to do it, because nobody in the world is going to give their car up for having to pay an extra £20 or £30 a year on tax. Nobody's going to give their car up. It's impossible. They give up everything else before they give their car up. And another thing, too, you see the councils. Right? See anybody who works for public services. See if you want to keep all your public services within public domain. I think it should be an extra 1% or 2% tax put on them. Anybody who works for public services. Because they're going to end up going privatised. I'm going to tell you why. See if they build an incinerator up in Mollusk. I can tell you now, the private waste disposal companies are queuing up to take over all your bins, all your waste.
What do you think of bigger taxes for bigger houses? Bigger bills, bigger houses?
It doesn't raise anything. It doesn't raise anything. It's pie in the sky. All it is window dressing, as they say.
Okay. Paul, thank you. Alex next. Morning, Alex. Thank you, Paul. Morning, Alex.
Morning. No, I just rang up because you were talking about having to revalue all the houses and the length of time that it would take. You know, the real value isn't important in itself. It's the real value in relation to the neighbour house. As long as houses are rated in relation to the value of their neighbours' houses, the neighbouring houses, it doesn't. You can have a real value and you can have a market value, and the two won't necessarily have to be the same. So I think going down to revaluing all the houses, just somebody will just delay any changes for
you. Well,
years.
It's not gonna happen anytime soon. Like as John was saying, that is very much pushed away into the future. Like you're talking about 4, 5, or 6 years time. Goodness sake, I could be dead by then.
I think there has to be something done. I mean, there's a change in the market housing over here. Even the size of houses that I live out in the country, and the size of some of the houses being built round about is you know, they're enormous and they're massive. Mm. And you know, they may have a Range Rover parked at the door or a big SUV, and they're probably paying £400 or £500 road tax on it. And yet they're not paying much
more.
They're not paying
much. You buy a big fancy car year one, the road tax could be over a grand.
I don't know.
My car's worth 20-odd grand, but you buy a car worth over 100 grand, you're paying a massive amount in tax. Let's speak to Anne Watt, director of the think tank Pivotal. Morning, Anne.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. What do you make of, look, the headline here is high value homes to face higher rate bills. Has the finance minister, and this is a proposal, if this goes through, is this a missed opportunity to bring in a lot more money in Northern Ireland or not?
I think it's inevitable that this is going to happen. It's the easiest win for the finance minister and for the executive in terms of additional revenue raising, because basically it affects the wealthiest people with the highest value homes. And so for the general population, it's not going to affect them. And they would generally be supportive of things which are of taxes and charges that are asking wealthy people to pay more.
But why is she protecting the wealthiest people? Why is the cap not lifted completely?
Well, we haven't seen the numbers yet, Stephen, so we don't know what she's going to do. I mean, the reality is, well, I think most people would say it would be unfair to give somebody a domestic rates bill of £25,000, which is what would happen to the most expensive properties. So we have to see.
It might mean they can't have two Range Rovers at the front door. Is that unfair?
Well, I mean, that's a judgment, isn't it? You know, maybe listeners and other people would say that's not unfair. But in England, certainly, the council tax is capped, I think, at £5,000. I'm not completely sure about that. But there is a cap that basically says people with more expensive properties do pay more, but there's a limit to how much higher it goes. So I think it's completely understandable the finance minister has done this, although I suppose I would raise a bit of a question, really, just because of the small amount that this is going to raise. So it's the headline news today and everybody's really interested in it and maybe lots of people are supportive of it. But in reality, it's going to bring in somewhere less than £10 million a year. £10 million is a big amount to anybody, you know, an ordinary person, but £10 million is not a big amount when you look at the whole of the public finances. You know, Northern Ireland's projected overspend this year is £770 million. So an extra £10 million is not going to make much of a dent in that. So,
well, that's the point. That's the point, yeah. Isn't it? That's the discussion point this morning. Northern Ireland, that's £770 million of a shortfall. And our executive is considering raising 10 million of what? 770? Yeah. So what are we going to do?
It's a step in the right direction, but it's a tiny step. And the reality is, Stephen, if we want decent public services, we have to pay for them. And that's a comment I'd make about the whole of the UK's public finances and about Northern Ireland's as well. The situation here we have with domestic charges is that we don't pay water charges. And our rates are also a bit lower than in the rest of the UK. So we're paying.
Well, is this a first step to raising rates?
Sorry, Stephen, I didn't hear that.
Is this a first step? Is this a first step towards raising rates for everybody?
Well, it might be. You know, the executive sets the rates every year. So raising rates, domestic and non-domestic rates, is a decision the executive makes every year. They don't need new legislation to do it. It's not like water charges where you'd be making a huge change and you'd need to do new legislation and so on. The executive just makes that decision as the start of the financial year approaches and it decides how much it's going to charge. Historically, the executive has raised rates only by inflation or indeed less than that. And so households haven't been asked to pay, you know, proportionately more in recent years, even though we've had such a huge stretch on the public finances. And the executive will always say that they're trying to protect households' finances and avoid putting financial pressure on people. And look, I would absolutely always say the lowest income households should be protected. But if we look at, you know, middle and higher income households, they probably could pay more. And, you know, households on average here are paying between £500 and £900 less per year in household charges than in England, Scotland and Wales.
And look, I'm not trying to push in any way this morning for people to pay more in Northern Ireland, but I am asking the question, if we've got this multiple hundreds of millions of pounds of a shortfall, is there any indication of how our local government sees that gap filled? Because if that shortfall continues, that means we don't have the money that we need for policing, we don't have the money that we need for Paul Given and education. So we've got to find ways of filling that shortfall that is beyond. We might, if we go cap in hand to the Treasury, we might get more money, but we've got to raise money ourselves as well, don't we? And what I'm asking this morning is there even a hint of any new idea or unpopular ideas that would bring in more money? And John Ann, just to go over that again, John is telling us that it is his understanding that when they look at that increase in the cap on rates, it's a modest increase. Why did they not go for a significant increase for the rich? Why wouldn't they do that?
Well, we haven't seen the numbers yet, so we'll see what the executive decide. I think there is certainly an argument for asking people who are better off to pay more. But if you think about it, Stephen, if asking people to pay, asking the wealthiest households, so these people in the most expensive 8,000 properties, so asking the very wealthiest people to pay, say, £1,000 more per year, that only raises you £8 million. So if you ask them to pay £2,000 more a year, those 8,000 households, it raises £16 million. The bottom line here is there are not enough very wealthy people in Northern Ireland to create enough revenue to generate enough additional money, unless you, you know, start charging them £25,000 a year, which I don't think many people would think is acceptable, really. So I think the
I'm not sure, Anne. Okay. The people that are going out, I don't know, but the people, and we'll find out. We'll get a little anecdotal find out this morning on the phones here, 03030805055. But for those people that are that are struggling to pay their way, for those people that, you know, lost the winter fuel allowance, and that is a big impact on them. For those people that are out earning 20 and 30 grand a year, they look at these people in 1 million, 2 million pound houses. And there aren't too many of those in Northern Ireland, but they do look at them. They look at people in the big cars. You know, cars these days, some of those these rich people, the cars these days are 120, 150 grand. You go out and try to buy a top-of-the-range Mercedes, BMW, Range Rover, you can't come home with any change out of 100 grand. And I just wonder how many working people in Northern Ireland want those type of people hit harder, take the money off them. 25 grand is extras on their 100 grand BMW in some cases.
But 25 grand per year, Stephen, that's a very high charge to be putting on somebody.
But we've got a very high shortfall in the amount of money we need to pay for public services here. And thank you. Morning to you. Let's find out from you. 03030805055. Loads of you calling us this morning. We're straight back after the news.
The Stephen Nolan Show.
Right, former DUP Special Advisor David Graham with us this morning. Former Special Advisor to the Labour Party Kevin Marr with us today. Morning, David.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Good morning, Kevin.
Stephen, morning, David.
Morning. Kevin, I'm questioning, I don't know the answer to it, but I'm questioning this narrative that, that few people in Northern Ireland would support the rich in Northern Ireland being hit with a 20 grand or 25 grand a year extra tax bill. Like, is there really much sympathy for these people that run around very, very rich while the working class are struggling to pay their bills?
It's very bold of you to start a program about local government finance, Stephen. It's also one of the most fiendish, complicated issues you can possibly discuss. But I think you're right. I think broadly, people will look at this and think, this sounds a little bit like, as Keir Starmer keeps saying, those with the broadest shoulders should bear the greatest burden. And that kind of seems fair enough. I mean, the devil, as always, with taxation is in the detail. And just as much as most people have an impulse to say, I probably pay enough tax, so let the guy driving around in the Range Rovers and living in the big houses and all the rest of it, they should pay more. But the difficulty is for all governments, and you know, the British Labour Party knows this to its cost over very many years, is that when you do bring forward proposals and try and make that argument publicly, try and have a public discussion to say richer people should be paying quite a bit more tax, quite frankly, for public services and all the rest, what you tend to find is lots of people who would not be in the scope of those tax rises feel that they might be one day, and that you kind of hit that kind of aspirational voter who then won't vote for a party that's going to raise taxes. And that's one of the great kind of conundrums in democratic politics, really. It's not just people who are directly affected, it's people who feel that at some stage they might be affected and therefore they won't back change.
David Graham, should we be expecting more ingenuity, more options, more ideas from our executive, not just Keith Archibald, for our entire executive, as to where to get money into Northern Ireland from?
Well, look, Stephen, I've been on this programme many times saying exactly the same thing, and it is that, you know, a caller earlier said that this is pretty much a stone in the ocean, and look, £10 million is £10 million, but when you consider the deficit that Stormont's going to work at, it worked to this year is going to be £770 million. I mean, that's, you know, it's pittance, really, in reality. Now, I mean, I think the bigger challenge is here to raise revenue makes really difficult decisions from a political point of view, because that then is bringing in water charges, prescription charges, things that hit you know, absolutely everyone. And I think that Kevin's entirely right about the aspirational voter. I mean, I think a caller on a previous show when you discussed the winter fuel allowance, not everyone that lives in a high value house, particularly within the older demographic, is necessarily cash rich. And there have been comments to say people in, you know, big houses with big heating bills really, really needed that. And I know there'll be a lot of callers will say, oh, well, there's limited sympathy for that. But, you know, a change of demographic and a change of circumstances makes this a much more difficult debate than saying, let's just tax people in big houses a bit more and then everything will be solved, you know?
But is it politically more difficult to put taxes up in Northern Ireland? And there are few tax-raising powers in Northern Ireland that are significant. But is it more difficult to put taxes up in Northern Ireland than staring at the public and telling them, we don't have enough money for your police force? We don't have enough money to build those schools. We're running at a 700 million quid deficit. So therefore, I'm sorry, we have to cut these services. Is that not equally as unpopular?
Well, that is the reality. That's where we're at the minute, Stephen. I mean, you've got Mike Nesbitt threatening to not make cuts, you know, regardless of his ministerial code and everything else. You've got an education system that requires significant reform because there are too many schools, because we have too many sectors. And the list goes on and on. You know, you had your show dominated last week because of roadworks and requirements regarding infrastructure. So, you know, that is where we are now, Stephen. That is the level of unpopularity. And as I said on the flow, you know, if there's a flow chart, it always goes back to we need more money. And where do we get that money from? Now, you know, unless the Treasury are going to hand us over more money, which is I think, almost an impossibility now. So if the begging bowl's not there, unless, again, we have some sort of foreign direct investment from someone that wants to come and, you know, build a significant economic powerhouse in Northern Ireland, the only other way is, as I said, going back to it, charges for your prescriptions and your water.
Kevin, what happens then over the next year, over the next 2 years, if we don't raise significant amounts of money and the Treasury doesn't give it to us either? So what happens to that 700 million a year that we're short? Like, what do we do?
It just becomes a yawning gap, doesn't it? I mean, it's a significant gap as it is already. But I mean, you know, you just have to look at the tenor of what Rachel Rees is likely to say as Chancellor tomorrow in her budget speech, which is the public finances are not in a great place at all. The economy is pretty flat. You know, I think you know, everybody can sense that. And therefore, public spending is going to be, you know, very, very tight for several years to come. And there's a 3-year spending review, which is currently being negotiated in Whitehall, which will obviously affect Northern Ireland as well. That's going to go on into early 2025. So there's a lot on the table, but there aren't very many options. And I mean, there's a kind of a slight paradox here that nobody likes, politicians don't like raising taxes, and the public don't like paying them. That's taken as a given. It's a bit like being a surgeon and the patient on the table there and agreeing to the surgery, and then of course as soon as you pull the scalpel out, they jump off the table. And that's very much the situation that the executive now, I think, finds itself in. But the paradox is that financial sustainability for Northern Ireland is something that I think both Sinn Féin and the DUP and the broader nationalist and unionist parties as well should find a lot of common ground upon, really, because you know, if Northern Ireland is financially sustainable, it kind of starts to wash its own face financially. That's good for it being in the union, but of course it's also good for Sinn Féin to be able to say this place is not an absolute black hole in terms of public finance. It's somewhere that actually is working and is valuable, but we're an awfully long way from that. I think that's the bottom line. And John made the point just when he was speaking to you before, Stephen, that what this is basically is about a system that is out of whack. The people at the very, very top are not paying anything like what they should be, and that the system deserves and needs to be reset. But the question is, you know, quite reasonably, why not be a bit bolder, frankly, and the rich pay a bit more than they're expected to do?
Let's see what we think at home this morning. William and Fred. Morning, William.
Morning, Stephen. Stephen, I don't hear much from you. Are you eating or hating? Can you put food on the table? The evil Tories. I've heard that for 2 years from you. Now, my pensioners are £500 worse off. Families got the £600 each family, if you remember that. So this and never away from food banks, food banks, them evil Tories. Now we're worse off under a Labour government. Why so quiet? Randomly speaking about the case now, why not beat this drum? It looks like evil Labour.
And what do you make of our local finance minister here and what she's doing with the rating system? What's she proposing to do?
Listen, I don't want to be rude. As far as I'm concerned, I've heard you for two or three weeks about Sinn Féin. I don't take Northern Ireland Assembly serious. I expect the Westminster thing to cover most things. They can turn around and hopefully get the peace. I don't take Stormont serious.
William, thank you. David, next morning, David.
Hello.
Go ahead, David.
Well, okay, what you're saying is tax the people with broader shoulders. You're not really saying that. You're saying tax people with bigger houses. Now, I'm all for that if they have broader shoulders, but I know Manny, his father passed away and he needed a house. The house is worth about £800,000. Now, this man, he's not well. He's disabled. He's not able to work. But he inherited this house, £800,000. He's not married. He lives by himself. Well, he has a car comes in to take care of him. But that man can't afford the rates in this house at £800,000. He's not rich. He can't work. He's disabled. Is it fair
he's asset
that
rich.
He's asset rich, yes. But should he have to sell his house that his father left him because he can't work? Because he's not well. Because the rates are too much. By all means, a house with seven people worth £400,000, with seven people living in it, seven adults living in it.
Well, look, that is
going to create more waste and more. It's going to need more bins. Going to need more water. It's going to cause more wear on the infrastructure with cars.
David,
they have.
David,
surely
that is
that occupancy is relevant.
David,
to what the house costs the taxpayer.
That is a strong, emotional, valid argument that you're making. Right? However, there's got to be some tough choices in this country somewhere. So if you don't take a lot more money off the rich, if the Treasury in the UK... Hold on a minute! If the Treasury is not giving us more money, if we're not taking more money off people in Northern Ireland who have it, then that will mean your public services for those people who don't have a lot of money in their pocket, they are going to continue to deteriorate. So there's not some type of magical situation here where we all yes. close our eyes and sing Kumbaya and everything's good in a year's time. We've got to find money to cut waiting lists. We've got to find money so that underprivileged children in Northern Ireland who are on the back foot can get a real good education in a building, in a school building, which is fit for purpose. We've got to find money for children with special needs. So
absolutely.
That there are enough school places
absolutely.
For them.
I'm
so where are the difficult decisions? Will we all just get together? Will I get the track for Kumbaya? How will we all just sing it together, close our eyes, and think everything's all right? Everything is not all right in Northern Ireland. We are significantly short of money.
They've said, raising the rates is a drop in the ocean. So,
right, so
Kumbaya,
where do we get it from?
Raise the rates if you want, but the thing is, it's not going to be enough. Why not do something effective?
So where do we... Boucher, the chief constable, he is warning us that if the police force goes any lower, he can't allow it to happen. He's warning us that we need significant amounts of money. You look at the prison system, Naomi Long, the justice minister, that prison system with the amount of money it has is broken. She needs more money. So where are we going to get it from?
Everything in Northern Ireland is broken. It doesn't pay its way, sadly.
So where are we going to get it from to fix it?
From what your citizens have said and you've agreed with is raising the rates isn't going to quite cut it to get enough money. Why not try and find... No, I'm not a politician. I'm not involved in finance. But surely there's another way where you can find the broader people. Wealth tax on people who are property rich, from what they have earned, those out in big Land Rover and things, they've got money. Of course they do. They've bought, by choice, they've bought expensive things. But a man who his father passes away and leaves him a house that's been in that family for generations,
and this
man sadly is unable to work.
I hear you. What you're saying makes sense
I'm
to a lot of people.
That people shouldn't pay. I'm not saying the richer. I the richer certainly can should pay more. That doesn't sort of belief. So it is that those who have should try and take care of those who do not have. And like you say, and I agree with you, those with broader shoulders should pay more. But what I'm not saying
they should. I'm asking. But what I'm definitely agreeing with that.
But what I'm saying is, those with bigger houses don't necessarily have broader shoulders.
Yeah, but some of them do. Some of them are very broad.
Yeah, of course they have. I'm not arguing that either.
All I'm asking is this. Is the public of Northern Ireland hearing from all of those great minds in Stormont? And I'm not saying that facetiously. There are some big minds there. There are big special advisors.
There's some big ears
there. Well, listen, park that for a second. Are we hearing anything from Stormont, which channels through to, well, that's a good idea as to how we might balance our budget. Well, that's a good idea as how we might bring in a lot more money. Fred's next. Morning, Fred.
Well, for some time
good morning. Thank you. Good morning, Fred.
Hello. Yeah. How are you doing this morning? Well, you mentioned people with broad shoulders, but sure, Stephen, you'd qualify for having broad shoulders.
Well, it shows you just how impartial I am when I'm asking questions here that will cost me
anyhow,
a few quid.
I'll go ahead here. No,
so
for too long,
that up people, your pipe and smoke it.
For too long, the people in the United Kingdom, and particularly in Northern Ireland, have been living in government handouts. And that can't go on forever. And some of your commentators there said that we need two things. We need water charges and we need a small charge on prescriptions. Hello?
And do you support that?
I would, yeah. Because there's an awful lot of waste in prescriptions. People get a prescription.
Are you having your breakfast this morning? I can hear you eating your cereal while talking to us this morning.
People get a prescription and they go about maybe get 2/3 of it taken and then they feel okay. And the rest is thrown out. And a small water charge, when there are plenty of people. Industry pays a very high price for water, as does agriculture. And like, why not spread this over? People buy bottled water, and they don't find any expense at that.
I haven't drunk out of a tap in about 10 years. Thank you, Fred. Morning to you. Dan's next. Morning, Dan.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, I would be sort of conservative in politics, and I would normally support the charging for water and increasing rates. But in Northern Ireland, why the hell should we? And before you run off on a tangent, the reason why I'm saying that is we are paying $400 million a year for an Irish Sea border, and those not for sale in the UK labels would have cost an extra $250 million. That's the price of our deficit. Surely one of the biggest...
It wouldn't be costing Northern Ireland that, would it?
Pardon?
How would that cost Northern Ireland? That wouldn't come out of the block grant or anything like it, would it?
No, you're quite right, it wouldn't. But it's compensate. That would be the British government should stop paying that and put the money into Northern Ireland, because we are paying extra money on our goods and groceries here because of the protocol. And so why should we pay any more? And we were told that the protocol was the best of both worlds. But the businesses that we were promised to come into Northern Ireland because of it haven't come. And a Labour minister said that the reason they didn't come was because they were unsure of the trading arrangements between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK because of the flipping protocol. Now, why should we pay a tax on our goods from Northern Ireland? Because that is what we're paying, because it's increasing the prices. And the British government turn around and say, they stymie our industry, make our consumers pay more, and they want us to pay more money as well on top of it. I would tell them to go and get lost. And I would be conservative in my politics. But I am
Did you vote for Brexit? Can you hear me?
Yes, Cahan. Yes, go ahead.
Did you vote for Brexit?
Here we go again. The Nolan backstop. You voted for Brexit, so suck up the courage. Look, we're paying £450 million.
Did you vote for Brexit? Did you?
No, you're paying £450 million because Ireland didn't want a border where it should be.
Did you vote for Brexit?
Absolutely, I voted for Brexit. Why would I not? I'm a free democratic will. That you are saying, they said the protocol was necessary to protect the Belfast Agreement. That was the reason why we had a protocol. Not because of Brexit, and because of a threat, a warning from violence from every Irish Republic and Nationalist Party, the British government, and you criticise the Ulster Loyalist Council, but the British government looked at the whole security situation here, and they said the least opportunity for violence was to put a border in the IC.
Okay. Dan, thank you very much. Peter's next. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, sir. Morning, Peter.
Right, Stephen. I just wanted to point out a fact there. Over in England, I see they've got what they call a single occupancy rate relief, and they get 25% off that. Now, that'd be pretty good if they could bring something like that in here for people who live alone. And also, if they're...
How could we afford it?
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, you know, it's not fair.
Every one of you this morning.
A single occupancy person there living in a house,
yes.
And maybe a house next door has got five or six people in it, and they're getting the benefits.
So but hold anyway, on a minute. Hold on. Let's think this through. Mm-hmm. So you would like money taken from the block grant and given to subsidise people that are living in 25% subsidy for people that are living in homes on their own. You think of the amount of homeless in Northern Ireland, you think of the amount of people that can't get on the housing ladder in Northern Ireland, and you want to incentivise those people who are living alone to stay living alone.
What about
encouraging people through a tax system to actually take in a lodger?
Yeah, but the same thing applies over in England. They have their issues as well, as we've seen regularly on the news. They have trouble. And then where will likely have this water rate introduced? And that 25%, I would like to think, would be included. Well,
the political
as well,
parties were out. Some of the political parties were out straight away saying no to water rates. Some of them were out straight away saying no to other revenue raising. I'm coming back to it again, Peter. You can sing it to me if you want as well. Either sing Kumbaya to me and tell me that everything will be okay. We have no idea how it will be okay. We have no idea how we're going to pay our way. Or tell me what we need to do to raise the money that we need for our public services here in Northern Ireland. What do we do?
Well, single individuals in a house are having to put that money towards the likes of that massive way debt up into whatever you want to call it down there at that bus station, £350 million. There's money going willy-nilly for all sorts of crazy things, but result in the likes of traffic congestion, all sorts of things, and we're paying towards that.
So is that the central station?
Central
station, of course, is trying to make Belfast a modern city with a modern public transport network. Why wouldn't you want to put money into that?
Everything's in hand. Don't worry about traffic congestion. We have that all in control. We'll go ahead and do this, and we'll see how efficient they are.
Thank you, Peter. Paul's next. Okay. We've got loads of calls this morning from right across Northern Ireland on this. Who says that budget and politics, people don't care? They care big time on The Nolan Show. Go ahead, Paul. Morning to you.
Hi, Ryan. Stephen, it's always a vicious circle. When they talk about these issues and they're going to increase the taxes for businesses and richer people, what happens is the working class and the lower end people end up suffering anyway, because these big end businesses just end up increasing the prices on their bottom line products, and the common person ends up paying for it anyway. So what I think they should do is look at big corporations like Google and Amazon, who's over here, and hit them a proper corporation tax. Now, these companies use grey loopholes.
Stormont can't do that. That's not a revenue-raising power within Stormont.
Yes, but there should be some sort of issue where the UK can do it, and then money has then dispensed over to Northern Ireland. But what I'm saying is some of these corporations have grey loopholes, and a lot of them use loopholes, and these foundations are set up to push some of their money away into their charitable situations. We honestly know that it's not all happening that way. So I think we need to tighten up on the higher-end corporations, and then it should be an even playing field for people in low-cost society. At the minute, it's not that way. They're going to push it on to higher-end people. They're going to increase the prices, and people are going to end up paying for it in the end of it anyway.
Paul, thank you very much. It's quite interesting, actually, that quite a few of you are protecting the rich people of Northern Ireland, fighting for them, arguing for them. I don't see too many of you arguing for me? I would invite your calls to do that if you want to. 030-30-80-55-55. Here comes the 10 o'clock news. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, everyone. It's the Nolan Show from the BBC. The former Alliance leader, Lord Alderdice, has said it is not politically realistic for the Alliance Party to refuse to declare where it stands on any forthcoming border poll. So would they support a united Ireland? Would they support Northern Ireland remaining in the UK? How would they vote? Professor John Tong is the co-author of this new book, looking at the history of the Alliance Party. What's the book called, John?
The Alliance Party of Northern Ireland, Beyond Unionism and Nationalism.
So do you think Alliance are going to be able to hold then the line where they don't tell people what their current thinking is around this constitutional question?
Well, Naomi Long said at the book launch last week that it was quite probable that Alliance would take a position. It's up to Alliance's party council to decide whether to take a position and what that position would be. I personally think it would be more difficult for Alliance to do that because their membership, whilst you need binoculars to see the importance of the constitutional issue to many of those members, they're not, it doesn't rate highly on their priorities whatsoever. Nonetheless, they are divided over Northern Ireland's long-term constitutional future. 38% of members want a united Ireland, 28% would prefer Northern Ireland to stay in the UK, and 30% say they don't know. About 4% said they would abstain in a border poll.
And is that in Alliance's own polling, or where are we getting those numbers from?
That's from the book where we did a membership survey, or we did a survey of all Alliance Party members, and they've changed. I mean, the party until the Good Friday Agreement was founded as a pro-union party, whilst rejecting the label unionist or nationalist. Since then, Alliance has been constitutionally neutral, and some people don't want within Alliance don't want the party to take a stance because they say, look, by definition, we'd become a unionist or a nationalist party if we were to take a definitive side in a border poll. Others, like Lord Alderdice, say you can't abdicate responsibility on the constitutional question. You've got to decide, you know, what your stance is and hold firm with that stance. But it is more difficult for Alliance compared to other political parties. As I say, their members are not fixated whatsoever. They don't get out of bed with, you know, thinking about the constitutional question. But let's face it, the parties on the unionist or nationalist side, they know how they're going to campaign in a border poll.
Do they know, John, what their stance is, but they're trying to keep it a secret?
No, I don't think they do. I mean, they changed their constitution to drop the belief that Northern Ireland should stay in the UK. They dropped that after the Good Friday Agreement, and they uphold the consent principle that is within the Good Friday Agreement, which at the moment supports Northern Ireland staying in the UK. Every opinion poll shows that there are more people support Northern Ireland staying in the UK than want a united Ireland, so far at least. I think that the issue will be then, well, okay, so Alliance meets to decide what stance they take if they feel they need to take a stance. And I think it will be difficult because, you know, it's comfortable at the moment when there's not a border poll imminent for Alliance to say, well, we are neutral, we'll look at the prospectus for united Ireland. And Naomi Long made the very fair point at the book launch that, you know, there's yet to be a prospectus written for a united Ireland. But ultimately, a constitutional referendum will pile the pressure, it will on any political party that, you know, hasn't taken a stance so far. And yes, you can campaign very civilly against each other. You know, Conservatives were in the Brexit referendum were campaigning against each other. The question is then, you know, can you heal those divisions after a border poll? And what would happen, I suppose, if Alliance chose the wrong side in a border poll? That would be another issue.
Well, remind me again what you just said about the split. So it's 30% undecided. These are the numbers from your book.
Yeah, 30% undecided. 38% of members support a united Ireland, say they would vote for a united Ireland in a border poll, and 28% of members say they would vote for Northern Ireland to stay in the UK. It was 30%, don't know. That's quite a change. The last Alliance Party membership survey we did was 20 years ago, and only one in six supported Irish unity at that point. What you've had is an influx. You've had a membership surge, not just a voting surge for Alliance, you've had a membership surge. And a lot of those more recent joiners are people who are more sympathetic to united Ireland, whereas there's plenty of loyal Alliance members who joined in the 70s who stuck with the party, and they still would be more pro-Northern Ireland in the UK.
I wonder how many people would join the Alliance Party if they knew what party they were joining in terms of the constitutional question. I wonder how many people don't join because they don't know what they stand for in that question.
Well, the members who do join, and they have had a membership surge, like the fact that Alliance is not fixated with the constitutional question. That's part of the attraction for many members for Alliance because, you know, they don't wake up every morning obsessing about constitutional issues. And for so long as there's not a border poll, you can argue, you know, that doesn't matter. Obviously, if there was ever a border poll, that's when things become difficult. I mean, Alliance members, I think the constitution question was about eighth or ninth on the list of priorities, whereas for members of other political parties that were surveyed, certainly, you know, constitutional issues are much, much more important.
So what is Lord Alderdice saying in this book then? How is he explaining his position that it's not politically realistic for Alliance to do what they're doing?
Well, he says that it's the job of the current Alliance leader, Naomi Long, to be thinking every day about how she's going to manage a border poll. That's the first point he makes in the book. The second point he makes is that Alliance can't abdicate on this question. Ultimately, they would have to decide. They'd have to take a stance because they can't just simply say, you know, we haven't got a position in terms of the constitution of Northern Ireland, because ultimately this is, you know, the biggest decision that people might ever have to make. So he argues, you know, it's not a credible position to sit on the fence, as it were, and the Alliance ultimately needs to decide. I don't think the Alliance needs to decide tomorrow, but obviously if there were ever a border poll, then Alliance, they've got three options, really. One is to take a definite stance and say and try and bind the membership to that. I'm not sure that's worthwhile because Alliance voters will make up their own mind anyway. The second one is not to take a position at all and just say, you know, do what you want. The third will be to take a soft signal position, as it were, and say, well, you know, on the balance of the evidence, we prefer either Northern Ireland staying in the UK or the United Ireland. But ultimately, you know, well, it's a free vote for members. You're not bound by any particular party discipline.
Is Alderdice, Lord Alderdice, is he putting his money where his mouth is? Has he told us how he would vote?
No, you'd have to ask Lord Alderdice that. He hasn't committed to a position. I mean, he has indicated that he thinks that you know, the prospect of United Ireland...
He's telling Alliance Party they should. You wrote the book with him. Well, did you not ask him?
Well, you'd have to ask Lord Alderdice what his position is. But, I mean,
my point, though.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly get your point. I mean, Lord Alderdice has intimated that, you know, he thinks he's talked to some extent about the inevitability of a United Ireland.
Yeah, and it's true. That's different, though, from whether he would support it or not, isn't it?
I mean, I think it was interesting. One of the more interesting survey findings was that a majority of Alliance members thought that a border poll would be held within the next decade and that a border poll should be held within the next decade. So they're certainly not frightened of one. But, you know, whether Alliance would actually welcome one, and whether, you know, it could be a nice civilised division of approach, because you're not going to unite, those people are not going to change their mind. That 38-28, I don't think they're going to now necessarily change their minds.
And to be fair to John, he's not in the Alliance Party anymore, is he? So
he's a Liberal Democrat. But
it would be interesting to know his view on a United Ireland or not. I know he said it's inevitable. Does he think it should happen? Okay. Look, John, thanks very much. Thanks for talking us through that. That's Professor John Tong. 12 minutes past 10. Buckler's got his wee suitcase packed, apparently.
A second Trump term would be a huge risk for America and dangerous.
She's destroying this country, and if she becomes president, this country doesn't have a chance of success.
Next week, America decides who should be its next president. And Good Morning Ulster will be broadcasting live from the States, hearing the views of voters as Kamala Harris takes on Donald Trump.
We're here to support that man. Right. And we just got stronger in our determination to do it.
I'm reinforced in my belief that he is an existential threat to our democracy.
It's a shame that my vote counts the same as your vote.
It's a shame that you aren't in the same reality that we are.
And it remains a close, contentious, and controversial campaign.
They're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats.
You talk about extreme.
The US election. full coverage across BBC News NI. And join me, Chris Buckler, for Good Morning Ulster, live from America, every morning next week on BBC Radio Ulster and anytime on BBC Sounds.
Right, so you may have heard about technology being used to bring musicians back to life through holograms on stage or voices generated by artificial intelligence. But what about recreating a talk show host?
This is Michael Parkinson, or at least a version of me in this rather curious AI form. Now, I'll be honest with you, I haven't the foggiest idea how any of this technology actually works, but I must say I'm excited by it all.
So that's not Parky when he was alive. That's a robot, a computer, AI intelligence, in other words, generating a replica of Sir Michael Parkinson's voice. It's spooky, isn't it? And of course, Parky, when he was at his prime time slot on television, he was just owned telly and owned the chat show. Here he is with Dame Edna Everidge.
That was excellent. Thank you very much for addressing the nation.
Oh, I'm the nation. We're watching you.
Yes, I was just wondering, actually, about this relationship, this frisson between you and Russell Crowe.
The what?
Frisson.
The frisson.
Was there a frisson?
There was a little bit.
Was there?
We make a bit of music together, Russell and I. I saw him years ago in a restaurant in Los Angeles with little Meg Ryan.
Obviously, we've got a problem there. We've got a big problem there with replicating Parky. I've been speaking to Mike Parkinson, his son, and asked him how this AI will actually work.
Well, it's kind of an extension of the work I used to do with my father. I worked with him for 15 plus years as a producer and collaborator, and we spent a lot of time getting hold of the rights to the archive, using the archive to create different shows together, books and live shows and whatever. And by the sort of last sort of couple of years of his life, began to talk about what would happen in terms of his legacy. And one of the ideas we had was a podcast in which I would converse with him, and he would talk about his highlights, the best moments, the worst moments, the behind the scenes stories. And we would use the wonderful archive to back this up. And, basically, what happened was, sadly, of course, his health deteriorated, and he got to the point where he wasn't really able to do anything. And we began to talk about, you know, what would happen to the archive when he was gone. And he said, you know, I want you to still make it relevant, still keep it for a new audience, and use every means in your power as my sort of business partner to keep this treasure trove alive, not because he had an ego, but because he just believed that the program that he did had a significance above and beyond just being entertainment. So when he did pass away, the podcast thing bubbled around in my mind, and I thought, well, is there any way that I could use the current AI in a sensitive way to maybe keep him as the host, maybe have a conversation, maybe just have him as the host of it? And I met with the two extraordinarily talented guys from Deep Fusion Films, Ben Field and Jamie Anderson. And they convinced me that they could do something much more. And that was actually to get my father, not my father, an AI iteration of my father as an interviewer, to actually have unscripted conversations with a new generation of guests alongside, you know, celebrating his archive on a YouTube channel. And that's where we stand today, really, on the cusp of something which is potentially quite exciting. But I also understand there's controversy around it as well.
Yeah, so look, I don't quite understand it all. So this would use all sure. your dad's words and
What happens is this: is there's a two strand thing to this. We have a YouTube channel which essentially is the repository for all Parkinson archive, all the great interviews, which will start with the ITV and it will spread out across. Then what has happened is that the AI technology, there's a proprietorial technology that Deep Fusion have got. And essentially what AI is a learning machine. So what we've done is we've created a learning machine which has access to every single one of my father's interviews. So it begins to learn exactly how he interviewed, how he approached interviews, his style of interviewing, the way he speaks, the way he interacts with people. And then what you do is essentially you place them in front of a real live human being. Give the AI everything they need to know, like I would with my father, a brief about the person they're interviewing, and the AI does an unscripted interview with them. Now, it is not free form in the way that no interview is free form. The AI is produced, the AI is prompted where necessary by myself as producer and the other two producers, Ben and Jamie. So it is an extraordinary interface between human and this advanced technology. I think it's thrilling on one side and sort of stepping into the unknown.
You must have obviously thought about this, that sometimes when people want to recreate something, it's never as good as what it was at the time in real life.
No.
Is there not a danger here in this?
Of course there's
a gamble.
But of course it's a gamble. But then on the other hand, I think you have to understand that if the technology is available to try and do something which is groundbreaking and something which, as long as it's done with editorial integrity, as long as it's done with the proper controls, the ethical controls, legal controls, why not try and see what the potential is for this? And I don't mean it just purely from a commercial point of view, but you have to look at also the way that AI is coming down the road at us all. And there will be a case whereby we will have to interface with an AI at some stage. Humans will have to interface verbally with an AI. And this is kind of, on one level, a great opportunity to produce some original new material in the style of my father's interview, but also to examine exactly how humans can interface comfortably with AI. So it's a multi-layered project. In no way, shape, or form is it going to be, you know, a direct replica of my father, because to a certain extent, AI isn't there in the room, as it were. It's not staring at you. It's not reading visual cues. It's not an understanding that probably as I'm talking to you now, you're probably doing something else. But what it does do, and what it has an extraordinary capacity to do, like my father, it can listen, and it listens intently to everything that you say. And because of that, it actually is an interviewer very much in the mold of my father, which is remarkable to watch, remarkable to listen to. Sorry.
You just don't see these one-on-one interviews very much on television anymore.
No, you don't. And it's a shame, because it's the oldest style of human entertainment. I mean, I would imagine that cavemen, when language developed, would sit around the fire exchanging stories. The verbal tradition is very, very rich in humans, and there's a real need for us. And I think that, unfortunately, now that there is a tendency to, in a sense, condense everything into a couple of minutes, condense everything into a soundbite, condense everything into a clickbait. This could give an opportunity for a different way of approaching an interview, and a different way of accessing someone's life story, which has never been tried before.
It's really interesting. Mike, thank you for talking to us today. Thank you very much.
See you later. Bye-bye. Thanks, Stephen. Bye.
That's Mike Parkinson, the son of Sir Michael Parkinson, Belfast Telegraph columnist Malachy O'Doherty, with us today. Good morning, Malachy.
Good morning, Stephen.
It's spooky, isn't it?
I tell you.
Like, you can't tell the difference.
And they that's the amazing thing
conversations.
About it. Yeah.
Is it amazing, or is it just... I don't know. Do you like it?
I don't like it. I'm worried about it. What amazes me is not just that it gets the accent right. That's incredible enough in itself. But that it gets his sense of humour. You know? It tells you... It makes jokes in that the real Michael Parkinson would have made. You know? So, Mike Parkinson's amazing and he's very clever in what he's doing and he understands what he's doing and he understands the implications of what he's doing. But, I mean, the other side of this, Stephen, is that for all those people who complain about the Nolan show, they can now bring back David and see, you know, and be done with it. So, I mean, that's the worry. The worry is essentially that we will not need human talent, because we will be able to replicate the human talent from the past.
Will AI be better?
Well, and what happens to our self-esteem when AI is better than us? You know, how do we, you know, Mike himself talked about, you know, we will have this interface with AI. He says humans will interface with AI, almost as if AI is another species. Where do we go when we're, currently, for instance, if I want to contact my phone company, I deal with a robot that thinks I'm young and says, how are things for you today? Cool, all the rest of it. But, I mean, it's going to get to the stage where that robot interfacing with me is going to understand me an awful lot better and maybe understand me better than my best friends do, you know. So what does that do for our relationships with each other as humans? What does it do with our own self-esteem? How do we then determine what the difference is between a human and a robot?
I was in Las Vegas. They've built a massive new building called the Sphere on the Strip. And I was there, I think it was about 5 or 6 weeks ago, something like that. And I put this on my Twitter feed, actually, at Stephen Nolan, where these AI robots, the level of conversation that they're able to have with you, what this robot did with me when I asked it a question that, you know, maybe wasn't favorable to it, it tried to turn the crowd against me and started asking the crowd, well, how many of you agree with that guy in the red shirt and why, and pointed to me and all of this. And it is scary. I found it scary. Other people might find it, you know, enlightening, and that's the modern technology. But my goodness. Look, what I want to do is not talk necessarily just about AI, Maliki. I want to remind ourselves about just how good human beings can be. And Sir Michael Parkinson, when he was alive, I was saying earlier, he owned television. He owned the chat show at one stage, didn't he? And sometimes I go back on YouTube and watch people like him. Here he is with Dame Edna Everidge as a guest alongside Lenny Henry.
That was excellent. Thank you very much for addressing the nation in our studios.
The nation were watching too.
Yes, I was just wondering actually about this relationship, this frisson between you and Russell Crowe.
The what?
Frisson.
The frisson.
Was there a frisson?
There was a little bit.
Was there?
We make a bit of music together, Russell and I. I saw him years ago in a restaurant in Los Angeles with little Meg Ryan. I thought, I'll have what she's having. That's what I'm...
But how have things been in terms of, can I say, companionship since Norm died?
Since my husband passed away, and how sweet of you to mention that in a lovely way you did. I've never been happier since my husband died. And I think if most women were honest, they'd say the same thing. I don't even wear his watch, isn't that sad? But he'd want me to be happy. I haven't actually sought physical relationships with men. I always thought that was a rather overrated aspect of human life, and I still do to some extent. I've dallied here and there, but I don't think this is the time or the place to talk about it. It's a family show, something I think Lenny forgot on a couple of occasions.
That's you too, not
Now, Maliki, are we really saying you could recreate that? And the answer is, you probably could, because computers could recreate Dame Edna, could recreate Lenny Henry, and the audience wouldn't know if that's AI or whether that is the real thing.
That's right.
That's what's terrifying about this.
Yeah, that is. And the genius of Michael Parkinson was fairly wide-ranging. I mean, I used to read, he's the only sports writer I ever read. He used to write sports reports in the Sunday Times, which are really, really eloquent and I suppose to use a fancy word, literary. He had that self-deprecating humor, you know, when he was on air, you know, that wee smile, which he was important to the whole country, but there was never an air of self-importance about him. I remember once in Morecambe, he was doing some kind of parade through the town. I think it was to open the Christmas, which on the Christmas tree lights or something, in about 1973 or something, you know. And I mean, the whole crowd, the whole town was out, you know, cheering for Parky, for Michael Parkinson, because he evoked such a human warmth. You know, he was a warm, amenable, genial human being, not laying things down in front of you and saying, this is how it is. But, you know, interacting with guests the way he interacted with. And what he did with Dame Edna there was he gave her space, you know. Others would have thought, oh, God, I'm being upstaged by this woman, this man, you know, and I need
Maliki,
to claw back my own space, and he didn't.
Maliki, thanks very much. Thank you all for listening today. We'll leave you this morning with Michael Parkinson, the real Michael Parkinson, speaking to Muhammad Ali back in 1971.
Look, can I go back to your childhood? When you were a kid in Louisville, did you get involved in fist fights and things like that? I mean, we were
a couple. I can remember a couple of little fights when I ran, but not too many.
They didn't appeal to you at all?
No.
No. Were you, in fact, did you have a gang in those days when you were a kid? Were you running with a gang?
So I was so busy, I didn't have time to run in street gangs.
Did you at that time, though, when you were 12 and in your early teens, did you ever imagine yourself as being world champion? You used to say
right. Well, it happened one night when I heard Rocky Marciano, 1954, 53 or sometime. He had beat Walcott or somebody, and I was in the rain on my bicycle, leaning over, listening to fellas' radio on the car. And I heard, I got there too late, and I heard the fellow say, and still the heavyweight champion of the world, Rocky Marciano, and all the noise. And a little skinny kid in Kentucky went about, I don't know how many stones it is, but 85 pounds and small. And it sounds so, I rode off in the rain on my bicycle. I could just hear the man say it. At that time, my name was Cassius Clay. And still the heavyweight champion of the whole world, Cassius Clay. I heard it as I rode off in the rain, and I said to myself, the champion of the whole world can whoop every man in Russia, every man in America, every man in China, every man in Japan, every man in Europe, every man in America, the champion of the whole world. It sounded big then. So I kept working until I did it.
I'm not going to argue with you.
You're not as dumb as you look.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @Stephen Nolan.